Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. More cancellations, I'm afraid. The past week saw the last minute cancellation of New Zealand's tour of Pakistan, which was closely followed by the ECB's announcement that neither the England men's or women's sides will tour in October as originally planned. We'll be trying to make sense of all that before talking about Virat Kohli's dual resignations, England-New Zealand, finals day, the final round of the county championship and much more. I'm Yaz Rana and I'm joined in the office by the Wisden Cricket Monthly duo of Joe Harmon and Phil Walker. But before I go to them, I spoke to Mark Butcher early today, who's in Leicester covering the England-New Zealand series of Sky. Last night, news broke that the ECB received a threatening email relating to New Zealand cricket in a press release. New Zealand cricket said, although this did not specifically reference the White Ferns, it was treated seriously, investigated and deemed not credible. We talked about what went on in Leicester, the cancellation of the Pakistan tours and the possibility of further cancellations this winter. Butch, for the second week in a row, we find you in a hotel talking about cancellations. First of all, is everything okay in Leicester?
Everything is okay in Leicester, yes. There was a bit of a scare last night, or, you know, some threats were made to the New Zealand and England women's teams, I think, ahead of the third one-day international that's due to go ahead at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And, you know, woke up this morning to hear that both teams are kind of happy or satisfied that it's, you know, not a credible threat and that the game will go ahead, which is obviously more than can be said for both England men's and women's tours of Pakistan, which were due to take place in the middle of next month, which is a real shame on so many levels. I'm kind of struggling to understand the rationale behind the trips being called off. But, you know, we're probably not going to ever be told the official reasons or what the threat was. But the stuff that I'm reading this morning tells me that sort of advice from the Foreign Office, advice from independent security companies was that the threat level hasn't changed, despite the New Zealand pulling out of the tour. And that, as far as they're concerned, there's no reason why they shouldn't go. So, shocker, really.
My initial reaction was, surely they could have found 15 players for both the men's and the women's tour who are willing to go. As you say, the official advice hasn't changed. And even in the statement that the ECB issued, they said that the tour wasn't ideal preparation for the World Cup. You're not going to get ideal preparation for anything at the moment, given COVID, given quarantine and all that. Am I being naive in thinking that they could have just found 15 players for both tours?
Well, I mean, I'm not even sure the players were asked, were they? The whole thing happened so quickly. I'm not sure how they could have canvassed the opinion of the players. I think the decision was sort of taken out of their hands. I mean, look, I honestly don't know. We got the issue with the Ashes coming up and sort of some players making sort of noises that they wouldn't be happy to go given the quarantine situations for families and whatever else. And I'm losing sympathy for these guys at the moment. But on this occasion, I'm not entirely sure. And again, I'm not the most well-informed person on the total ins and outs of the Pakistan trip being cancelled. But I'm not entirely sure that the players would have been canvassed about this one at all. This one looks like a unilateral decision taken by the board not to go. Now, in the case of the men's trip was almost a kind of like a thank you to Pakistan. A sort of, you know, a little bit, not quite an exhibition, because both teams have got preparations for the World T20. So it was completely valid, but it was also a sign of goodwill to a smaller board, a board that has had more than its fair share of troubles over the last 15, 20 years, to say thank you for sort of, you know, for Pakistan teams spending a lot of time on Plague Island over the last two summers. And, you know, solidarity and sort of welcoming them back into the international fold by the visit of one of the big three. And to call that off when the team would have been there for, well, a week? How long were they supposed to be down there? I don't know. I mean, if that's the way you treat your friends. And, you know, it's simply a case of, you know, India pull out of England. India is stronger than England. So India leave us. We leave South Africa. We don't go to Pakistan. It is a case of poo rolling downhill, isn't it? Basically, as for the women not going, I mean that's a huge chunk of their preparations prior to the Ashes and prior to the 2022 World Cup just gone up in smoke. You know, they hardly play enough as it is. And, you know, it'll be interesting. I'm off to Leicester today to do the third one day international, and it'd be very interesting to find out what the players have to say, or if indeed they're allowed to say anything at all.
We haven't heard anything from any of the players. We haven't heard anything more than the official statement from the ECB either. But international tours feel increasingly precarious at the moment. The New Zealand's tour of Pakistan was cancelled minutes before it was supposed to get underway because of a yet unspecified security threat. On last week's pod, Phil made the point that the more cancellations there are, the more that players feel emboldened to take matters into their own hand and pull out of future series. What's your take on that and the possibility of players not travelling to the Ashes for either portions of it or the entirety of the tour?
Look, we're in a situation now whereby, and this isn't the case across the board, and it certainly isn't the case for the women, but we're in a situation now where players, because of their financial stability and because of the choice that they have to play in tournaments that are not international cricket, or their choice to kind of to take part in some tours and not others, that yes, that is a huge threat. I mean, the Ashes thing for me is I'm slightly furious about the idea that players are thinking about not going on an Ashes tour because they're worried about the quarantine requirements for their wives and kids. Now, wives and kids going on trips in my time was very much a privilege. It wasn't expected. And I know times have changed a lot. But given that everybody is having to make various sacrifices, lots of things are different because of COVID, it seems to me that the only people who are not willing to make any of that, you know, this is a one-off Ashes trip, right? Chances are next time it comes around, 4 years' time, everything will be relatively back to normal and you'll have your families there for Christmas or the rest of it. But this is your job. It's how you earn your money. Now, if you're earning that much money that it doesn't matter to you whether you go on an Ashes trip anymore or whether or not there are no consequences for you pulling out of an Ashes trip and you just get welcomed straight back into the side again on the other side as though nothing has happened, then things have taken a pretty bad pass. And, you know, the future of touring, the future of long-form cricket, the future of these types of events start to become very much in jeopardy. Look, nobody at the moment, the only person that's sort of stuck their head above the parapet has been Stuart Broad. You know, funnily enough, he said, I'm going. It doesn't matter. Whatever happens, I'm going. It's an Ashes tour. He understands what that means. I'd like one or two others to sort of stand up and do the same thing.
Mm. Anderson has said the same as well. I think it's quite interesting with them that Broad doesn't have a family and Anderson's family isn't a young one anymore. What did you think about the withdrawal of players like Butler, Bairstow, Wokes and Milan from the IPL? I took that as them doing that to increase the chances of them being able to go and willing to spend the entirety of the winter in Australia.
Yeah, well, that hopefully is the reason behind that, but it becomes increasingly difficult to say that with any certainty. The logical thing from a cricketing point of view would be to do exactly that. Mm. And I will ask them to forgive me if that is the exact reason why they've done it, and that they are not thinking about not going to the Ashes, then fine, because that would entirely be the right thing to do. Mm. You turn down, you know, it's personal enrichment, the IPL, the Ashes is representing your country. And you know, so one would infinitely be more important than the other, particularly given that the situation financially that most of these guys are in is not what I would call a precarious one.
We complain a lot about how condensed the schedule is. I don't know if you saw this, but the BCCI released their winter schedule yesterday, and there basically isn't a gap of more than a week from now until the end of their tour of England next summer. What do you think should happen? Players are mentally knackered. Virat Kohli's resigned from two of his captaincy gigs in the last week. You're going to have more and more instances of B-sides playing supposedly full internationals. And I know it's partly due to COVID, but in the last year or so, we've almost normalised not picking your best side for a test match. What do you think should happen?
Well, as much as I've sort of torn into the idea of some players, you know, being happy and not playing any cricket, it would seem, the boards are just as much at fault, if not more. I mean, what you're basically saying to the players, we're expecting you to pull out. We know you can't do all of this. If you want to, then you can. But we know you can't. We're expecting you to, some of you not to play. Some of you won't make it. Some of you's careers will end. But we're just going to keep piling on the fixtures. And again, you know, the circumstances are extreme because tours being cancelled are trying to be rescheduled into gaps that almost don't exist. So again, there's understanding there. But this has always been travelling in this direction. You know, the gaps have become smaller. The amount of tours, the amount of fixtures, you know, teams playing money-making 50-over and T20 tours outside of the cycles of World Cups and things like that. That's all about revenue and volume. That's not about playing cricket that is meaningful in any way. So that the situation has been coming for a long time. And if it hadn't have been COVID, it would have been something else. There'd been another reason to have packed everything the way that it's being packed. And what you get is a diminished product because of that. If teams are happy sending their B team or C team to go and represent the country, then the sport itself suffers, isn't it? And eventually it eats itself.
What do you think will happen? Because every time there's a cancellation at the moment, there's the promise to then add more cricket into a calendar that was already right to, you know, it couldn't really be added, anything could be added more to it. So what do you actually think is going to happen? The England South Africa series a year ago, that hasn't been rescheduled, but supposedly will. England are saying they want to go to Pakistan again. India are saying they're happy to play a few more games in England next summer. You know, if you're getting players pulling out now, what do you think is the most realistic way of sorting this out going forward?
I honestly don't know. I mean, the only realistic thing to do is to go, right, year zero. Nobody owes anybody anything. And let's work this out with a blank sheet of paper. Which is tough on the people who have lost out, but I don't see how you can keep up these commitments when they're short of finding another 2 months. Got any ideas for month names? You know, I don't know how you do it. I honestly don't. And it just makes it, if teams are sort of are not honouring commitments that they perhaps should, that they're kind of putting off for spurious reasons, then you only make that backlog worse. Mm-hmm. And the expectation rises that, or the thought rises that there are certain countries who will, you know, people will come to England to bail England out. England won't help you out. And eventually that bad will tip over into something whereby you end up with a split of some sort. You know, India already don't play Pakistan. You know, everybody else is now deciding not to play Pakistan as well. You know, that is not a good situation. It's a terrible situation. And yet, there still isn't enough time in the calendar to get everything in that you need to get in. I think the boards need to be braver, and I think there also needs to be sort of like a back in the old days. I remember 2001, we travelled to India on the tour after the 2001 Ashes, and it was post 9/11. So one or two players didn't go on that trip. There were security concerns about India, you know, which ended up sort of in 2006 with what happened there in Mumbai. And the team went back and played in Mumbai, stayed in the same hotel, you know, after that. But in 2001, this whole thing was all very new. We had, you know, the army sleeping in the corridors of hotels, etc. Weren't allowed to go anywhere, weren't allowed to leave. But the players who decided not to come, that was fine. But it was held again. They were then not picked for the subsequent tour of New Zealand. It was like, we're not having people picking and choosing their tours. There will be consequences about that. Now it seems to be that you can pretty much do what you like, and it doesn't harm you in terms of your selection somewhere later down the road. And I don't know if that's a sustainable thing anymore, because as I've said, the players now are financially so comfortable that they can make a decision based around, okay, well, I'm not all that keen on going to Australia for the Ashes this year because my family can't go, but it's not going to, you know, I've still got my contract and I've still got this, that and the other. So, and I'll play next summer. So there's no problem. There's no jeopardy in deciding not to do your job. And that is what it is. You signed a contract to play cricket for England. My job is to play cricket for England, right?
Phil and Joe, I want to hear your takes on the cancellation of the Pakistan tours. This feels like the worst of the lot out of the many cancellations we've had recently. There's a line from the announcement that sticks out for me. This is the ECB press release. There is the added complexity for our men's T20 squad. We believe that touring under these conditions will not be ideal preparation for the ICC Men's T20 World Cup, where performing well remains a top priority for 2021. The PCB's new chief, Ramesh Raj, is understandably not happy. He said today, "I'm severely disappointed in England's withdrawal, but as expected, because this Western bloc gets united, unfortunately, and tries to back each other. So you can take any decision on the basis of security threat and perception. There's a sense of anger because first New Zealand got away without sharing information about the threat they were facing. Now England was expected. But this is a lesson for us because we go out of our way to accommodate and pamper these sides when they visit. And when we go there, we undergo strict quarantines and we tolerate their admonishments. But there is a lesson in this. That is that from now on, we will only go as far as is our interest." Joe, let's go to you first. What do you make of all this?
Well, you can certainly understand Ramesh Raj's frustration. I've been thinking about this a lot over the last 24 hours or so. And the more I think about it, the more angry I get, really. I think it's worth separating out the difference between what's happened with New Zealand and England here, and that the New Zealand government received what they believed to be a specific and credible threat. New Zealand were already out there. I'm afraid at that point, I think New Zealand have no choice but to come home. I mean, the other option of staying there and something happening is just unimaginable. So I think we need to separate that from what the ECB have done, which is seem to use that as an excuse to pull out of a tour. And then offered some kind of very flimsy explanations to do with mental well-being and preparation for the World Cup. I mean, first of all, in terms of mental well-being, they're talking about the issues that players have had of living in a COVID environment for as long as they have done, as though they didn't create this schedule that is ridiculous, unsustainable, greedy. And then it gets to this point and they turn around and say to Pakistan, "Sorry, we can't come to you because our players are in this state," as though they didn't cause the whole thing in the first place. So I think it's pretty shameful, really, for that to be reused as the excuse here. What I would say, and I want to make this clear, you probably gathered, I think England should go. I think England should send a squad out there. But I would add that if England players, individuals, didn't want to go to that tour, I think that's absolutely understandable. No cricketer should go somewhere they don't feel comfortable. But I'd be amazed if England couldn't have put together a squad of 15 to go out to Pakistan for this series. England players have been going to Pakistan for several years now in the PSL. Other countries have been going to Pakistan for several years. England would be able to find a squad if they wanted to. And, you know, you could say that is not ideal preparation for the World Cup, as they say. Well, sorry, you planned this tour, you arranged this tour, you agreed to it. That has to mean something. And if you start pulling out of tours without any justifiable cause, then that's a very, very dangerous precedent. I mean, they've stuffed them here, really. This is precedent for now. Countries will feel they can pull out of a tour of Pakistan without really giving a justifiable reason. Australia are meant to be going to Pakistan in February. Do we think that's going to happen? I mean, no chance. They've got a shameful record on pulling out tours they don't particularly fancy as well. So, yeah, it's pretty dark stuff. And Ramesh Raj, I mean, his statements are as colourful as his commentary has been in the past. But, you know, I can completely understand his frustration. And they've been really badly let down by the ECB here.
It's important to say that the British High Commission in Pakistan today said that there's been no increase in security risk of going to Pakistan, that they fully support the tour going ahead. And they even clarified that the ECB is not a branch of the British government, such as the reaction in Pakistan.
And the security organisation that the ECB uses had obviously done their own independent checks as well and had okayed the tour. So every T had been crossed and every I had been dotted regarding the safety of the thing. For a four-night stopover, basically.
Yeah, that's also very important to add as well, isn't it?
4 nights. And so to hide again behind this COVID thing is spellbindingly hypocritical, considering what Pakistan did last summer to pull England out of a hole.
Why do you think they pulled out? Because I genuinely don't know. Because the reason they've given, I just don't understand. If preparation is not ideal, there's very little that's ideal at the moment. Why didn't they send 15 people out Mazhar Irshad, the well-known Pakistani statistician, tweeted today, for 3 years in a row, the largest contingent of overseas players in the Pakistan Super League has come from England. Mm. 14 UK players traveled to Pakistan for the PSL in 2019, 15 in 2020 and 12 in 2021. Forming a group of 15 players for two T20Is wasn't really that difficult. I genuinely don't understand why England didn't send out a squad.
No, and it's a fair question, and I don't think we'll ever get a reasonable answer. I heard what you said to Mark in that pre-recorded interview absolutely stands up, as if they couldn't have found 15 cricketers prepared to go. Pakistan were not expecting England's A-star team to turn up. That wasn't ever really in the deal. And that's okay, because there is something bigger and more potent at play here. There is an obligation and an imperative for all kinds of reasons to try and get this thing on. And if it meant that a few players who might have been appearing in the IPL or who might be multi-format players, if they weren't coming and some of the second-tier players were coming, then so be it. So be it. It would, as Mark said in that piece, it's hard to imagine that the ECB have, in the last 72 hours, gone round every single player, surveyed every player, tried to possibly twist arms and found that they're not for turning. That's probably unlikely too. The subtext, there are two subtexts to me. One, they never wanted this tour in the first place. They were doing it as a favour. And two, it feels like a bargaining chip to persuade certain people to turn up on that plane to go to Australia.
That's my inclination, that they're afraid of what might happen, even if it hasn't even materialised yet. I'm not saying the players have said, we're not going to do this if we have to do that. But maybe it's just a fear that is now...
It's a bargaining chip. That's how I read it. And players are saying something has to give. And Chris Wokes said it. And it came from the right place. You know, Chris Wokes pulled out of the IPL. But his phrase resonates. Something had to give. Well, I think the ECB have seen an opportunity here to lighten the load, to use COVID and this spurious security scare as a smokescreen for them to just chip another week off the schedule and try and use that as leverage along to persuade certain players who they need to be freed up and prepared morally to go and play in this increasingly soulless looking pageant between two very privileged institutions who expect the direction of travel to flow towards them and them alone. And it's hard to quibble with anything that Ramiz, or rather it's hard to quibble with the tone of what Ramiz Raja has said, because, all right, if you use the term Western Bloc, then that's inflammatory and that will inflame the base. But you absolutely understand where he's coming from, because for too long there has been that sense of the haves and the have-nots and those who call the shots and those who don't have the heft and the power to really stand up to this kind of hegemonic two-tiered effect in international cricket. And if he can't temper his tone because he's absolutely furious, then I absolutely get that as well. I respect that.
And the have-nots can have even less. It's being reported that Pakistan, the PCB could lose up to 15 to 25 million US dollars if the Australia tour doesn't go ahead, as well as the two tours already lost.
And this is, I completely agree with Phil's reading of why England haven't gone, but it still doesn't explain why they haven't sent a B team, a Lions team, apart from maybe they just think it's too messy and they can't be asked. I mean, that. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. And the frustration is that this tour was, I mean, it's been talked about for a long time, but it was confirmed in November, the men's tour. The women's tour was confirmed in January. What has changed between now and then that the ECB didn't see? They knew their fixture list.
Yeah.
They knew there were concerns about security in Pakistan. The fixture list has been as busy as they planned it, and security is still as it was in Pakistan. So that there is no justifiable cause for this.
No, I think in general, it's a bit simplistic to blame national boards and administrators. But I think the threshold has been breached on this one, and I think even the most kind of balanced observers of English cricket find it impossible not to join the queue condemning this particular decision. They had a chance, Joe, to do something really quite seismic here. Because as soon as the New Zealand story came through, we thought, oh, we all did, didn't we? And we knew there was this kind of air of inevitability about it. Well, they had the power to, in one swoop, change so much of the narrative around this notion of international cricket being squeezed to within an inch of its life, to this notion of the powerful punching down on the powerless, which is so much a part of the modern narrative now, and with good reason. Increasingly, they had a chance to really redirect that narrative and do something courageous for the game. And instead, timidly, they just fell into that kind of predictable place. And people are looking at it and feeling enough is enough.
Do you think, obviously, they felt enabled to do this because of the security risk that New Zealand suffered. Do you wonder, in a way, whether what happened with India at Old Trafford has also liberated them to think, well, you know, if that's the way things are going, if you don't want to play, you don't have to play. And in turn, Ramiz Raja has turned around today and said, well, we're not going to bend over backwards for you guys. This is a very dangerous knock-on effect that we've got here. If no one feels they owe anyone anything,
hugely,
then the whole game suffers.
Well, that's the saddest part about this. It's last summer, English cricket was on its knees. West Indies and Pakistan come into the eye of the storm and one of the countries worst affected by COVID in the world. They came over here. They had to endure very long quarantine periods. Pakistan ended up staying in facilities far from luxury in Derby. They went through all of that. Pakistan have been some of the closest friends to English cricket over a long time now.
They've come here basically every year
since 2016. They've come here, and they've come twice in a row when England and the UK have been severely affected by the pandemic more than anyone else. I think it's desperately sad that England haven't reciprocated that in any way.
And it's also, we haven't heard from anyone at the ECB today, that no one's fronted up to the press. There's that statement last evening. I mean, that's shameful in itself. And the only reason you can think why that hasn't happened is because there are questions that are too difficult to answer.
Mm. Yeah, the final thing to say on this is it's rare that you see everyone in English cricket kind of on the same side. I've not really seen anyone arguing that this is fair and legitimate in any way.
It feels the fabric of the international game feels under threat more than ever in my memory, at least. And I don't think that's over dramatic anymore, because it just keeps piling up. Every week we sit around this table and we have to disseminate the latest grim shit show. Excuse my language. And this is the latest. Everything seems to now be playing out on some kind of geopolitical, diplomatic level. Pakistan and India don't play each other ever. And now we have this latest example. As you say, Australia pull out left, right and centre. England aren't going to Bangladesh. They're not going to Pakistan. They'll find a way to get the Ashes on, no doubt, because that's the pageant that brings in the bucks. But this is not what we're here for. This is not what the game is designed for. It's not designed to make money. It's designed to serve the many millions of people who adore it, in spite of ourselves.
Moving on to a topic that's not wholly unrelated. The IPL kicked into gear on Sunday, but the big news from Indian cricket over the last week has been the twin resignations from Virat Kohli. He's resigning from both the India T20 captaincy following the World Cup this autumn, and also the RCB captaincy following this year's IPL. And I think in relation to the fixture list the BCCI put out yesterday, where the Indian first men's team, basically don't have a gap of more than a week and a half from now to the end of their tour of England next summer, you can see why Kohli wants to play less cricket. Beside all these discussions that we have, there is just so much cricket. And you got the biggest named player in the world stepping back from two gigs when he's still, you know, he's still 32. I'm sure he doesn't want to resign in any way or form, but this is the way in which he feels he needs to survive as an international cricketer, which is quite sad, I think.
Yeah, well, we spoke about it last week. For all that many threw the book at India for the Old Traffordshire muzzle, they are the most pliant and, in terms of days on the park, hard-working cricket team in the world. And again, that phrase, something has to give, well, it's given with Kohli. I think it's a smart move. Actually, I think it's a very astute move on his part. Even somebody as, you know, pushing the edges of sanity with how intense he is regarding his game and bringing that incredible energy to the thing, that can't go on in perpetuity. And so, yeah, I think it's a smart move, and it'll probably end up kind of extending his stuff in the really, really big stuff elsewhere.
I guess that's the positive to take from the Coley news, that if he's giving up these two jobs, he probably really wants the other two for as long as he can hold on to them for.
Yeah, absolutely. But I still think it will hurt Coley to be in a team and not captain it. It's almost unimaginable to think of Coley on a cricket field and not being captain now. I mean, it won't come easy to him. I'm not sure what he'll be like to captain as well. That might be quite interesting.
It would be great to see Sharma, because they're the yin and yang, aren't they, of Indian cricket. It'd be great to see Sharma just sort of striding around. Sorry, Virat, a little bit finer. No. A bit squarer now. I just can't wait to see it. You might be touching on this, but this is totally kind of going back to what we said. I just want a word out for Wokes and for Broad. I think Broad was actually mentioned by Mark Butcher, wasn't he, regarding what they're prepared to do for this winter coming up. And I think that is a positive element of it, that Wokes and others dropped out of the IPL in order to make themselves available for other more seismic moments for English cricket this winter. So there are still players out there that are making the kinds of decisions off their own bat that, you know, us as fans want them to be making, you know. And the final component of that Ashes squad, if it does go ahead, will be interesting to see. But of course, in the end, we want England's best cricketers on that plane rather than the plane to the UAE to play a bit of smash and bash.
Yeah, in fairness though, the four guys who are most likely to play in that out of the IPL group all pulled out of the IPL.
Yeah.
Broad said he's going to go.
Yeah.
Anderson said he's going to go. So I think the signs are better than they were 2 weeks ago.
And there's a lot of criticism at the minute of player power, and I think that's worth pointing out regarding that collective of players. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. At the time of recording, England are 2-0 up over New Zealand in an ODI series. When I spoke to Butch this morning, it was before the third game was going on. Right now, New Zealand are 13-2, chasing 179. England recovered very well after, I think they were about 80-7 or something like that.
Brunty.
She's
reliable, isn't she? Reliable source of runs down
absolutely,
the now.
Absolutely. Well, I caught up with Butch to discuss the first two games of that series, including Charlie Dean's impressive start to international cricket, as well as finals day that took place on Saturday. Talk to me about Charlie Dean. So she's a 20-year-old offie who took a fourfer in the second ODI. So her first series as an international cricketer. She looks like she gives it a rip and also doesn't have the most conventional release in her off break. There's like a wrist flick going on. What are your impressions of her?
It's a sort of a Moeen Ali type sort of action on the ball. Yeah, I mean, she looks handy. She bowls a really sort of attacking line to right-handers, sort of, you know, foot and a half outside off stump, which means she does, you know, she does get driven through extra cover a little bit, whatever, but it also offers up wicket-taking opportunities. Yeah, she seems pretty fearless, you know, just straight out of playing in for the Vipers and whatever, very, very popular. All the girls sort of jumped up and down for joy when she got given her cap and all that kind of stuff. So England need an off spinner. They haven't really replaced Laura Marsh from, well, when did she last play? Would have been the World Cup, wouldn't it, in 2017. Australia, the problem for England always is that the women's team is always being compared to Australia. It doesn't matter what they do against anybody else. Kind of doesn't matter. It's them and Australia. Australia have just won their 25th game in a row, beating India last night. And they have a lot of left-handers in their side. So England are kind of desperate to have somebody that might turn the ball away from them. So good start for Charlie Dean. And, you know, England want an off-spinner. She is one. She bats pretty handily as well, decent in the field. So, you know, they're very keen for her to keep playing a part. And that four for the other day will give her a massive amount of confidence.
Danny Wyatt on recall scored an important half century in the second game from number 7. There was an interesting moment where she was involved in a run out with Lauren Winfield Hill, her likely rival for a spot in both the side and the squad for this winter's World Cup. She's opened a lot in the semi-recent past. Were you impressed by what you saw of her at number 7?
Yeah, I mean, she played really well, actually. She had to dig England out of a hole, so it wasn't simply a case of going out there and and doing what she does in T20 cricket. So she had to sort of get herself in and get a partnership going. She had that one with Winfield Hill. Both of them trying to put the bat in. You know, I mean, Lauren Winfield Hill got past the 20s and whatever, and she needs a score at the top of the order. But it was interesting because England obviously went in sort of a seam bowler light, and Danny Wyatt plugged in there at number seven where Catherine Brunt would probably normally bat. And she played really, really well. And has given England an option down the order, should they feel that England have got lots of bowling options. You see, so Heather Knight is very underused, but when she does bowl, she tends to be handy. But she's an off spinner as well, and so England might find scenarios during the course of the World Cup, or I was going to say a tour of the subcontinent and Pakistan, whereby they don't need quite as many seam up bowlers, and they can sort of plug the gaps with Heather Knight bowling at the top and play an extra batter and Danny Wyatt. So that's done no harm whatsoever. Batting down there, was it 60 odd not out, and actually got England up to a total that they looked like defending from the very beginning, but then before the rain came down in that second ODI, it looked like they'd lost the game. And then this bizarre calculations of Duckworth Lewis ended up sending New Zealand back out there with a higher rate than the one that they left the field with. You know, they're reliant too much on a couple of players, New Zealand. Once Sophie Devine was knocked over, England were favourites from there on in.
What are your thoughts of England as a side with the World Cup not that far away?
I think they're a good team. I think they lack a certain amount of boldness. I think that quite often their actual superiority does not show itself. They play at a slightly conservative way. That means that on paper, you look at that, you line them up against this New Zealand team, and you think, well, woman for woman, girl for girl, they've got them covered. But it ends up being a little closer, a little bit more nervy, perhaps, than it ought to be. And I think if they can find a way of taking the handbrake off a little bit, that they would be destroying teams and really kind of giving Australia notice that they're coming for them. But they're a good team, you know. On any given day, they can beat the very best. They can beat Australia, and nobody else really should be able to live with them. Mm. But I think a little flick in the switch in terms of attitude and actually putting their dominance out there a bit more would be key for them.
Did you enjoy finals day?
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I got Nick Knight got a big money transfer to the IPL, so I ended up having to present the whole thing. Despite it being a long old day, it was a lot of fun. Cricket wise, there were some magic moments, weren't there? I think it was perhaps not the most compelling cricket throughout the three matches, but all of them had wonderful moments. And of course, the Jordan Cox thing was just that was out of this world. That catch. That's as good as anything I've ever seen. We're just staggeringly good.
That was an amazing 15 minutes, though, because you had the Jordan Cox catch that wasn't allowed, and then everyone's, you know, flicking through the MCC law book and obviously remembering law 19.5.1 that says that there's got to be a bit of intent when there's contact between fielders for the umpires to overrule that. And as you said on commentary, I've never seen that before. Like, I've never seen anything like it before at all.
No, and the thing was sort of on comms, you're kind of looking at it and you're thinking, I know why they're looking at this, but I didn't know 19.5, whatever it was. But then when you read 19.5, there's no intent there, is there? I mean, I'm not quite sure what Daniel Van Drummond was doing there, because he was kind of running in the direction of the ball, but not really looking like he was ever interested in taking the catch. And all he just got in the way and nearly smashed the bloke over. It was just, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So, but anyway, you know, they got the decision wrong there on the day. But it allowed us the catch that came afterwards might not have happened otherwise. So yeah, it was worth it just for that. You see it on, who was out there now? It was Mike Burns was one of them, wasn't he? And Bumble, I think. And I sort of lip read. Burnsy saying, I've got no idea what's happening.
I wasn't at the ground, but just watching it off the television. There really are very few days like it on the British sporting calendar. And we talked about the blast a lot on the pod this year. But the knockout stages, the Blast, have been brilliant. They're easy to follow. The four quarterfinals were brilliant. The first semi-final on finals day was excellent. And it's, you know, the crucial difference between the business end and the Blast and the group stages is that it's easy to follow. Do you think that English cricket just needs to make a bigger deal of the business end of the Blast?
Well, yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, it's needed to have made a bigger deal of the Blast full stop. Ever since it started, really, it's always been a really good fun product with some brilliant cricket, some brilliant moments in it. It's just never, English cricket has never really taken the opportunity to push it as being something that is worthy of that sort of attention of IPL or even 100 levels of attention. Now, the being easy to follow part is huge in that, and I've complained about this working on it and playing on it for years, that if there are 7-8 games all happening at the same time, it's impossible to kind of to keep track of what's going on and who's doing what, and you miss all the water cooler moments and stuff. And that's one of the things that the 100 has provided, isn't it?
Hmm.
Now, I think the future of the Blast is very interesting, because there's no doubt whatsoever that the 100 has now usurped it as being the sort of like the main competition, and that's whether people like it or not. It just is. You're going to have to get used to it. So what happens to the Blast? You know, how do you go about fitting it in, making sure that it's relevant, making sure that sort of there are high profile knockout stages, making sure perhaps that it actually has a reason to exist alongside the 100, and, you know, a perfectly valid one and a really important one. I've got my own ideas, but I'll save them for another time.
Well, thank you very much, Butch. I'll let you get on with your day. Enjoy the rest of the England-New Zealand series.
Yep, I'm off there now.
Joe, what was your moment of the week?
Oh, good. We can talk about something fun and enjoyable and something that actually happened rather than got cancelled. It was, of course, Super Kent winning at finals day.
Super Kent.
Hashtag
edit
Super
that out.
Kent.
You're allowed to use a hashtag now.
Have you seen Rob Key getting very angry with the Kent Twitter account? You've seen this, have you?
I haven't,
no. So he's saying that, so Joe Denley bowled for none by Chris Rushworth, hashtag Super Kent is the kind of what they do on every tweet on,
right,
the Kent,
so
on
even
the Kent
when
account.
Your main man's got
he's got a bit frustrated with it. But on this occasion, they genuinely were...
Super.
Very good. I was going to say very good. This is a famous old club that's been starved of silverware for a long time. Is it 14 years? Yeah, 14 yeah. years since the last trophy, discounting the Division 2 title a few years back. They've had some pretty tough times financially. Even this year, championship-wise, it's been a bit of a disaster after you tipped them for the title, mm-hmm. Yaz.
Doing well in Div 3, though.
Doing well in Div 3. and they had... Their team was decimated by COVID. They had to put out a second string or even kind of third string at one point. So to see them do it at finals day was very heartening. I mean, it's remarkable they haven't been there for so long. They've had three quarterfinals in the last 6 years. And Key did say at the start, it'll be how they deal with the pressure of a finals day. Can they continue the form they've shown in the South group, which they topped? And they were fantastic. They were by far the best team on the day. Had some tricky moments in each game, but came through them fantastically well. And the hero of the day, without doubt, was young Jordan Cox. And a bit of Darren Stevens, but largely Jordan Cox, who got a golden duck in the first match, the semi-final against Sussex. And then took Kent from what was looking like a sort of decent-ish total, but not a match-winning one, to what actually looked like a total they could defend. Hit a kind of 50 and 20-odd balls. And then in the field, as Butch touched on, did the most extraordinary parry piece of fielding you've ever seen. Finals Day is still, as you and Butch discussed, is still a great day in the English cricketing calendar. It is like nothing else. And it was good to see Kent actually get there and finish the job. I remember Ryan McLaren taking a hat-trick in whatever year it was, 2007.
Yeah, 2007.
Joe Denley was in that side, wasn't he?
And Stevens, yeah.
And Stevens as well.
Yeah.
So that's got to be the longest stretch from
I mean,
one
pretty
win
much,
to another.
That's
probably the stretch of the whole
exactly.
tournament. Yeah.
You'd have thought so. Oh, did Stevens get to a finals day with Leicestershire?
So Stevens won it in 2004, 2 weeks after Archie Lennon's birth.
Scene of my mascot race, 2004.
What? You were in it?
We've been through this.
We definitely have not.
Well, maybe not on the show.
Okay.
I finished 13th out of 18. Very creditable, I thought.
And then had a run in with Lanky the giraffe after.
Really?
Yeah, he called me all kinds of things in the dressing room. Honestly, he squared up to me. That's another story.
But yeah, I thought Kent were really impressive. Really strong batting lineup. Bell Drummond was excellent in the semi-final.
Yeah.
And then with the ball, they were quite weird in a way in that you felt they were almost searching for the final eight overs a little bit with Stevens, Denley and Stewart. But Klaassen, Milnes and Qais Ahmed are really excellent.
Really good. I mean, you would say across the four teams, shorn of a few overseas players, they weren't gun attacks on day, I would say. You look down the Hampshire and Sussex batting lineup and they looked a couple of batters short as well. But even if the quality wasn't always fantastic, the entertainment was great. And I think I'm pleased with Sam Billings as well, who I think he's taken a bit of stick from a section of Kent fans for not being perceived, not being committed enough as club captain to the cause, and that he goes off and plays in the IPL. He's obviously got 100 gig. He's been unfortunate with injuries. He plays for England as well. There is a sense that he's not around that much, and does he care? And I mean, from speaking to him a few times over the years, he absolutely does care, just because other opportunities to present themselves to him, because he is such a talented player, doesn't mean that he doesn't care about the county he's come from, and otherwise he wouldn't have bothered taking on the captaincy. I don't, the county captaincy is great when you win at finals day and you get to hold up the trophy. I get the impression county captaincy is often not much fun. So if you take it on, you're not doing it for the grandeur. I think you're doing it because you care about the club you're playing for.
Mm.
I do like this my struggle Sam Billings narrative.
Anyway, moving on. Just a quick mini pod announcement. We've set up an email address, podcast@wisden.com, for listeners to send in longer questions, thoughts or bits of feedback to us. That's podcast@wisden.com.
Have we had any yet?
We've had a few and we'll get to a couple.
We had a nice one straight in, which was absolutely justified the podcast account.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve. For next week's show, though, we want to hear listeners' moments of the summer. So anything from an amazing game that you played in, a lovely day out at a game, a cricket book you read, a catch, an innings you watched, anything vaguely cricket related. We'll be reading out a few of them on next week's show to coincide with the end of the English summer. So send those into podcast@wisden.com.
Are we doing the season roundup next week?
Kind of in two parts, because the county championship finishes this week, and then you've still got the Bob Willis trophy. Did you know that did you know that the Sheffield Shield starts before the English season ends?
Oh, this is your thing, isn't it? Yeah,
it's not my thing.
It is your thing.
You do look like looking at calendars. You do enjoy it. an inspection of a calendar. Well, you know a lot about the calendar.
Fair enough. Anyway, as these two mentioned, that we've had a few questions in already, so thanks for those. So Steve Connor wrote in to say, I keep seeing people arguing that a better marketed revamped Blast could have done the same job as the 100. I sort of get it, but I struggle to see what it would have looked like, particularly without upsetting those same people that dislike the 100. Is it really a case of the Blast just needing better marketing? As been mentioned on the pod before, following the Blast is almost impossible until the quarterfinals. I can imagine a revamp with an 8-team Division 1 to allow for a game-a-day format, but presumably this would mean ECB cash boosts for those top 8 teams to draw in the best overseas players, and it would also in turn lead to players moving to those counties over time. It seems to me like a top division plus a load of cash would have a similar effect as the Premier League did in football in widening the gap between big and small teams. That's before you get onto how a women's competition would fit around it, and I also instinctively feel that counties are a tough sell. I don't think people strongly identify with Middlesex or Leicester. I think there are a lot of valid points in there. Joe, do you want to respond to any of that?
Yeah, lots of very sensible points. I think, to be honest, in the past, I've perhaps fallen into the trap of saying, oh, just the Blast needs better marketing if it's going to kind of be elevated to another level. And I do think the ECB definitely could have done more, but there is an inherent problem with having 18 counties and trying to make a competition that is compact and easy for people to follow. It just doesn't really work in that sense. It's got loads of other things going for it, but that is a failure of the makeup of the tournament. And we saw with the 100, whether you like it or not, it is easy to follow. The schedule works perfectly. And I don't think the Blast ever could have become that. I don't really want to go down the route of, I'm still feeling tired after the cancellation chat, to be honest, but in terms of the 100 versus the Blast. But I think the way they need to improve the Blast next year, however you do it, is to not have the group stage so separate from the quarterfinals and then so separate from finals day, I think you just lose all the momentum you've got. We are, as promised on a previous show, going to sit down and map out our own domestic schedules, because at the moment we all just say what we think should happen, but none of it fits together.
No one knows.
That's why we need to figure it out.
At least give it a go, yeah. So we will.
Phil, anything to add?
I think Joe summed that up brilliantly, and also a brilliant letter, right?
If that's
brilliant. The standard. Steve, I know. Is it?
Yeah, Steve, yeah.
You don't get that kind of stuff on Twitter, do you?
No, you don't. Like,
superb work. Sign him up. I think Joe's absolutely right. One thing maybe to add on top of that is that one of the possibly unintended consequences of the 100 and the reaction against the 100 from your rank and file county fan is that there is an even more of an attachment to your county, because you feel like it's a more existential threat to it. And so what we saw, albeit with this laughable 2-month gap between the end of the groups and the start of the quarters, what you did see was some quarterfinal games that were memorably brilliant. You know, the game down at Taunton was an absolute stunner, and they were sellouts apart from the Chesley Street game where it was a neutral ground. All the other games were basically sellouts. They were heaving, brilliant atmospheres. And what you saw as well on Saturday, admittedly, I was at a wedding, but I did watch the highlights on Sunday morning. And what you saw was cricket that really meant something to the punters and the players, and therefore the people who were watching on TV as well. And it has substance to it. So despite the fact that it feels like it's been pushed to one side a little bit, if there is some kind of unforeseen benefit to having the 100 sort of bulldozer its way into the heart of the season, it is that there might be a knock-on effect in a positive way regarding how people attach themselves to their T20 sides, and by extension to their 50 over sides. Clearly the schedule is a balls up. I have a lot of sympathy for Alan Fordham at the ECB, who's got to try and pull the whole thing together when he's got 1,000 different voices in his ear. I don't think there is much more that could be done regarding the fundamental point that Steve asked about regarding the marketing of the thing. I think it's hard. I think it always has been hard. I think it's hard to bring in newbies into this peculiar world. I think that was one of the good things about the 100, unquestionably, and that was the fundamental point of the 100, and I think they did that relatively well. I think that if we'd been able to do it in county cricket, in 50 and 20 over cricket, then we'd have got a bit further down the line, but it is inherently difficult.
I do agree with his point about the knockouts, though, and I've said it before, I think the knockouts should be on free-to-air television, if at all possible. I think what is different between the Blast and the 100 is there's an infectious enthusiasm in the crowds. I think that if you're not previously engaged with T20 cricket or English domestic cricket at all, I think you'd actually get more invested in the Blast semi-final, quarter-final rather, at Taunton than you would at any 100 game. That atmosphere was just unlike anything you really get in English cricket, and I think it's really important that is showcased to as many people as possible. At the moment, it isn't really.
And you'd like to think that Sky, given some of what they've done in recent years, might be open to that as well. They do seem to see the benefits now of not just keeping it all under their umbrella, because actually by showing it to people, they might have a bit more interest and potentially come on board for more cricket and even a Sky subscription, possibly.
Definitely. We've been recording a few of our podcasts recently from Sixes Cricket Club. If you haven't heard about Sixes, Sixes Cricket Club is the new cricket-themed social entertainment venue with restaurant, bar and cricket nets. All Wisden podcast listeners can receive 10% off their food and drink by quoting Wisden10 on their booking notes. The final round of the county championship began early today. Hampshire are playing Lancashire, Warwickshire are up against Somerset, and Notts are playing Yorkshire in Division 1. Hampshire started top, followed closely by Warwickshire, Lancashire and Notts. One of those four teams will be champions. Lancashire have started pretty well. They bowled out Hampshire for 143. If they win that game, oh no, Lancashire 12 for 2 after 13 overs. So who knows? I'm not going to predict it.
Basically, we have no idea.
We have no idea.
I think
one thing you can say is if all these games get 2.5 days cricket, then you'll get results in each of them. Judging by the pitch at Trent Bridge in particular, and I've been at Chelmsford today, which will be in Div 2. Yeah. Result pitches and then some.
Well, Joe Clark scored a brilliant 100 today at Trent Bridge on a very, very green wicket.
Literally a wicket that you can't see. And just rubbing it in, there's a wicket next to a pitch next to it that you can see. Pretty grassless. Yeah, look, Joe Clark, we talk about him a lot. That is a potentially very significant 100 in this lad's career, because this is a big, big game. They were 70-odd for three at lunch, and he's made 100 here. I haven't seen much of it, but you say that he's played well. And this is a player that, well, he makes four-day runs. He makes white ball runs yeah. as well, but he makes four-day runs.
I wonder if it's significant, if not necessarily win it, if they qualify for the Bob Willis Trophy final, and then he gets a televised Red Bull game, and kind yep. of what we were talking yep. about, Josh Bohannon last week. You know, Nasser and Atherton need to talk about something for a couple of days, then suddenly they see Joe Clark. And I think with Clark, more so than probably any other uncapped batsman outside the England team, is when you watch him bat, he just looks class. He like instantly looks better than the average county batsman.
And especially when there might be a few Ashes spots up for grabs.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly. Phil, what's your moment of the week?
It happened today. Day one of the final round, and I went to Chelmsford, and it was Ryan Tendershatta's send-off. And at lunchtime, the Essex players made a guard of honour for him, and his partner and their two children were there, and he was introduced by the chairman, and then he took the microphone and spoke beautifully for a few minutes. The ground was packed, absolutely packed. And I think
Division 2 finale.
They do get a trophy, though, if they do finish seventh. Yeah, they do get a trophy. And I was talking to
Ken.
Did
Ken get one for Division 3 as well?
No, I don't think you do. I don't think one does, rather, Joe. And I was talking to someone at Essex, and they were wondering how to recognise it if they do win that mini league. What do you do? Do you social media it to within an inch of its life, or do you just kind of recognise, all right, it is still, you've finished seventh out of 18. What does that really amount to? Anyway, by the by, Tendershatta's send-off today. He's 41 years old. He's retired from all professional cricket except for his swan song in the T20 World Cup, where, of course, he still turns out for the Netherlands. So he spoke very much from the heart for the crowd at lunchtime, and then I was lucky enough to have an hour or so with him afterwards, just the two of us. And it's probably one of the most rewarding interviews I've ever done. I knew he was a cut above. I didn't know he was quite as impressive as he came across today. And this was a conversation that touched on cricket, but was more about life itself. And I know that sounds pompous, but it was. He spoke about race, diversity, identity, the wonders of the NHS, where he said he echoed a line that he gave to the magazine last year. His children were born premature a year and a half ago, and he said in the 2.5 weeks him and his partner were in the hospital, he didn't hear the same accent once. And from an itinerant cricketer who's led various different lives, that's a really beautiful thing to hear. And it's not the kind of thing that you hear cricketers say. He spoke powerfully and with real conviction about race in South Africa, where he grew up. He said something fascinating regarding one of his regrets from his career, being that he didn't speak up enough. He didn't use his platform enough. He said that cricketers and sports people, by extension, can be reluctant to come forward, can be reluctant to put their head above the parapet. And he said he's felt guilty in his career for not having done that enough. And he had a conversation with Stephen Davis, the Somerset cricketer. And Stephen Davis famously, you know, came out and so on and so on. And he said, Tendershatta, that if there is one thing that he really does regret, it's that he didn't use his platform a little bit more. But listening to him talk, and hearing what he's planning for his next chapter, if you like, I think that platform will be there for him again. I really do. And I'm not getting carried away here. He speaks so unusually, and his experience is so vast, and he's so intelligent, and he has that kind of that indefinable thing that you call integrity or something like that. He's already done level two coaching. He's completing his level three soon enough. He's been on the Gary Kirsten coaching course. And he sort of said rather embarrassedly that he kind of came out right at the top of that and so on and so on. So he's got Kirsten essentially as his mentor. And he said, I want to coach at the top of the game. He said, that's what his end game is. It'd be hard not to see him coaching Essex at some point down the line. And genuinely, fast forward 5 years, he has all the components that you'd look for a national coach. He's worldly. He's intelligent. He's empathetic. He has immense respect within the game. He's been successful hugely as a captain that completely turned that rabble around. And I can see him going as far as you can go in the coaching game. I really can. Now, look, that might be nonsense.
Feels very Mikel Arteta pre-Arsenal appointment.
maybe.
No, but I think it's worth just dwelling on his playing career as well. He's been at Essex for nearly two decades. He famously averages 67 ODI cricket, 29 first class hundreds, average of 44. He's just a brilliant player who's been at the forefront of Essex's recent success as well.
And he took them up from Division 2, then oversaw the incredible championship win in 2017, and then of course the double in 2019. He wasn't captain of the T20 side, but he was still a key part of that side. And of course they won the Willis last year as well, with him still involved in that setup. His record is astonishing, but it's deeper than that with this fella. And you don't look. You've interviewed 1,000 cricketers, Joe. I haven't really come across too many like this, I have to say.
And if he's doing the Gary Kirsten Academy, which is presumably in South Africa,
I don't know. Actually, I assume so. Yeah.
Is he intent on staying here? Is that what he wants to do? Does he know where he wants to pursue his coaching career?
Well, he lives in East London, Essex border now. There's a little clique of him, Lawrence, Wesley and Harmer, and they all live very close to one another.
Really?
Yeah. his family are based here. His children are born here. I would be surprised if he were to relocate to South Africa. I don't know for sure, of course. But he was very clear about what he wants from his post-playing career. And conversations have already been taking place with Essex regarding him staying involved in the club in some way. And that may come to nothing in the short term, and this is not a scoop because the chairman said it on the microphone in front of the whole ground this afternoon. But yeah.
It could be a fun swan song at the T20 World Cup, actually, in that, to be honest, I didn't realise quite the strength of that Netherlands squad. Phil and I have been doing our team previews for the next magazine over the last couple of days. Well, they had five players in the 100, was that?
Five players in the 100, don't ask me to name them. Van der Gugten, don't know how you pronounce it.
Klassen, yeah.
Brandon Glover as well, who got 100 gig, albeit he didn't play. Obviously, Satendra Shastri.
Colin
as well.
Ackerman.
And Ackerman as well. So, yeah, I think Ben Jones Cricviz has predicted that they'll beat Sri Lanka and qualify.
They were by some distance the best team in the qualifying tournament in 2019. The 2019 World Cup format got a lot of criticism, fairly, for only being a 10-team tournament. And the first part of the T20 World Cup is, in effect, a qualifying tournament, as Ireland captain Bal Burney has said on the record before. But it does provide a really good opportunity for two teams you don't normally see at the business end of a World Cup playing against the best teams in the world to play a lot of games against those countries. And Netherlands, Scotland, Oman, Ireland, they've all got a really good chance of being one of those teams. So that should be really interesting. And it's not that long till we get there. Just finally on the County Championship, it's been reported that the County Championship will return to a two-division competition again next year. We'll discuss that in more detail next week when we look back at the county season in more detail. I'm sure counties, if that does happen, will have very differing perspectives on how they should decide who is in each.
I think the winds of change have taken it down that route now. And I think what's happened in the last couple of weeks with teams realising just how little there is to play for 12 of the 18 teams, I think that's maybe
brought
the argument forward.
It'd be interesting to hear from some of our listeners who have watched a lot of county cricket what they want, because I'm still not really clear. I got a clear idea of what the counties want. I'm not really sure what fans think about the conference system, whether they'd like to see it continue. So
yeah, definitely. Well, use that email address, podcast@wisden.com, to let us know what you think. In the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy, Scotland captain Catherine Bryce scored the second highest individual total in the competition's history this week, 162 for the Lightning against the Sparks. She put on 207 for the second wicket with her sister Sarah, which is very nice. A fifer for Hannah Jones for the Thunder eliminated the Southeast Stars out of the tournament. The Stars won the Charlotte Edwards Cup recently. There's another big score at Bristol. Western Storm skipper Sophie Luff scored an unbeaten 157 as the Storm beat Sunrisers by 36 runs. And Georgia Elwis continued her fine form with the bat as her 84 not out helped defending champions. The Vipers chased down 257 against the Northern Diamonds. Question from David Shervington. Who are the breakout stars of the women's domestic summer for you? So I've picked out a few here. The obvious one is Alice Capsey, who we talked about a lot. 17-year-old central in the Oval Invincibles success in the 100 and the Southeast Stars Charlotte Edwards Cup win. Eve Jones isn't really a breakout star, but she's an uncapped player, has been around for a while, had another really good summer, one of the few left-handers in the English domestic game. And London Spirit all-rounder Danielle Gibson, who I think is only 20, she looks a good player. She's matched a rapid 40-odd in 100 game that suggested she's a player of high potential. And Emily Arlott, who won her first England call-up for the India series earlier in the summer, but I don't think it's actually paid for England.
I don't think she did play, but she was brilliant in the early part of the summer.
Yeah, she took a hat-trick, I think, bowler. Or four wickets and over. It potentially was a hat-trick. Both. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's 23, swings it loads, and also is a pretty good aggressive lower middle order batter as well. So I think she could be someone who England have a look at. Quite a lot.
Charlie Dean's playing in this series. Right arm off break bowler. Bit taller than Maddie Villiers, who's their other off break option. And she's bowled well in this mini series from what I've seen. And going to Australia, assuming that it goes ahead, etc., etc. They've got a lot of left handers. And I think they'll be looking to try and blood her in the big stuff against Australia as well. She looks like a good player.
She's a more attacking bowler than Villiers, I think. Really, really ranks it. Overnight, we had the first Australia-India ODI. Teenager Darcy Brown was the player of the match, taking a fourfer. All four of her wickets were top five Indian batters. Australia chased down 226 with 9 overs and 9 wickets remaining. Rachel Haynes hit 93 not out. That is Australia's 25th win in a row in ODI cricket, which is just ridiculous.
It was interesting seeing Darcy Brown and Elise Perry take the new ball and have very, very different returns. Elise Perry only bowled 4 or 5 overs, I think, and went almost at 10 and over. Yeah. Darcy Brown taking 4 for 30-odd. And it does feel like there is that kind of changing of the guard going on in Australian cricket. In terms of the bowling, I think Elise Perry's still got a huge amount to offer as a batter, particularly in 50-over cricket. But she's not the force she was with the ball. But they've got more coming through. And it's, you know, this is where English cricket wants to be and is getting close to being now.
Mm. I think with Brown as well, she's like genuinely quick. She's pushing mid to late 70s as well. And I think 2 or 3 of her wickets were like short balls that hurried the batters as well. So something different for batters in the women's game to contend with there. Another big piece of news this week. Lassith Malinga announced his retirement from all formats of cricket. An all-time white ball great. Most men's T20I wickets of all time. World Cup winning captain in 2014, 3 ODI hat-tricks, 2 T20I hat-tricks, most wickets in IPL history, 4-time IPL champion, so one hell of a player. But it almost feels that players have multiple retirements these days, isn't it? I'm pretty sure he retired.
I have to say, I thought he already had retired.
Yeah.
But, one of my most memorable cricketing moments ever, Lords, day before a test match, Sri Lanka test match years ago, and I stood right behind Taranga, the old left-handed opener, right behind him. So I'm basically 25 yards away from Malinga running in and he was bouncing him ball after ball. And because it comes from that trajectory, it's just horrific. Shouldn't be allowed. And I stood there and imagined what it would be like and realised, my God, I could never have got anywhere near that. 1,000 miles from any kind of level of that sort of cricket. And yeah, stunning one-off of a bowler, really. And made the game more fun, more colourful.
Absolutely. There's a really good video on YouTube of Malinga playing one of his early test matches in New Zealand. I think it's early 2005. And he's got short hair at this point.
Yeah.
And it's a really flat one, ball draw, search for the scorecard. I think the game's nowhere near a result. And in the second innings, he takes a fifer where he just takes the pitch out of the equation. And the New Zealand batters have no idea what to do. So, yeah. go searching that. Just a brilliant cricketer. When I was younger, I used to sling it loads. I used to get called Slinger Malinger all the time. But then that was ironed out of my action.
See, that's the problem in this country. We need to just make the most of your natural talents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A question from Rob McGregor. Hearing Butch refer to Michael Atherton as Athers on a recent show, I felt compelled to ask, are there any really inventive or out there nicknames in cricket? Or do the panel have any specific favourites that they've heard along the lines of one size fits all in football?
Well, I think it's fair to say that nicknames have taken a dive in cricket, right? There used to be a few better ones, but now it is very much your kind of your broader, your rooty.
Yeah, they're disappointing. Topically, Afghanistan for Mark War as the forgotten war. as Afghanistan was burning throughout the late 80s and so on, but no one really paying any attention. That was Mark War's nickname, which I thought was sort of grim. But at least he had a political edge to it.
Yeah.
So I've got, do you know what? I've actually brought up a piece that Phil and I wrote together. I don't know why we couldn't do one of us take this on. It was the 10 best nicknames in cricket.
Wow.
Which we wrote many, many years ago.
Daisy.
That was one I was going to pick out. Peter Daisy Hartley.
Some days he does, some days he doesn't. I always liked that one.
That was a good one. We've obviously got the King of Spain, Ashley Giles as well. Yeah, I'm not sure how much this was actually used, but it's a nice one anyway. Do you remember Mondi Zendecki, the South African fast bowler?
All hands on deck.
All hands on deck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah, that is good. That's the Fitzhall equivalent.
Yeah, that's the Fitzhall equivalent.
That's
good.
Are there any more? I feel like it's been
something a bit rude for the podcast.
Oh, really?
I mean, my club. But as soon as we're off air, I'll tell you a dozen my club. They're all sensational and all completely unrepeatable.
On the club game, Joe, a word on the game of cricket we played on Friday.
Last ball thriller.
Absolutely.
This was actually, so Yaz and I were playing for the Final Words podcast, Adam Collins podcast, second best podcast around in the game, alongside a bunch of his listeners, which that's some very good cricketers among them.
And a lot of whom listen to this show as well.
Yeah. One of them, Dan Price, deserves a shout out, who batted beautifully and got man of the match for an excellent diving catch at the end. But yeah, it all came down to the final ball, three needed ball, creamed out to cover point.
Who hit it?
Dean Wilson of the Daily Mirror.
Sensational.
He wasn't getting back for a quick two.
No, he wasn't.
Picked up smoothly on the boundary, pelted in. They only get the one run win for the Final Word podcast.
So a little bit Gupsall just shy of his ground.
It was very much so, but there was no dive.
Yeah.
No. Thank God for that. He'll be there down there now.
Todd deserves a mention.
Absolutely.
That game was completely dead until Tar came in, and he did really, really well.
Have you not
heard
about this, Phil?
No, I haven't. No.
Should we do this after
the show?
No, they love it.
Yeah.
Do they love it? Tell us at podcast.
I think his innings deserves a bit of praise here. They needed about 10 and over, and Tar basically was the person behind them staying in check with the required run rate. Yeah,
I think it's fair to say he was as surprised as anyone.
he needed it. It's been a tough return to the turf.
He hit a glorious back foot punch through kind of cover point for four in the last over off a very good seamer actually, Declan. So yeah, that was Tyler was excellent in that game.
Oh, the boy needed that.
Well, I think that's everything from today's show. We'll be back next week. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. If you want to get in touch, fire us an email at podcast@wisden.com and remember to tell us your moments of the summer. Cheers.